this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a cartoonist and illustrator whose sharp, satirical work appears regularly in magazines and newspapers, including The Spectator and The Sunday Times. Born in America's Midwest, but living in London for over 30 years, she's best known for the character Mimi, a self-involved fashionista in dark sunglasses, typically drawn with a glass of wine in one hand and an unnamed infant in the other. It's All About Mimi was published in 2013 and subsequently ran as a weekly cartoon in the Mail on Sunday. Her new graphic novel, however, is a notable departure. The award-winning Polar Vortex, an illustrated story, is autobiographical, depicting the author's return to her hometown of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, after her mother, who's showing signs of dementia, is hospitalised. The story explores grief, mortality and family wounds with poignancy, wit and the delicate line work its illustrator has become known for. Denise Dorrance, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you so much. What a great introduction.
Well, it's really lovely to have you here. And full disclosure, we are, our partners are brothers.
So yes, all the better.
we can put that out there and then
we can talk about them if you want.
They probably won't listen, will they? So, Denise, you were born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. That's the Midwest. That's all I know about it.
Oh, right. Okay. Do you want to know a little bit about it? Well, it's probably not what you expect in that I grew up in quite a big city, not a small town, although it is known for farming. And it's, of course, where the first caucuses happen in the presidential election. So it's quite important globally for that, but otherwise it's not very well known. It's literally in the middle. If you fold a map, it's right there. So I grew up there, and as quick as I could, graduating school, I moved to New York.
And previous to that, you were living with your parents.
Yeah, I was.
Tell us about your relationship with your mother at that point.
So I grew up in not a super religious, but it was Lutheran, which is pretty normal for that area. And my mother was a frustrated at-home woman, I think. I can say now in reflection, probably. She was probably not very happy being stuck at home. But gave my sister and me and my brother a very strong sense of who we could become. Because I think of her frustration, she really, it wasn't pressure, but there was a kind of lovely freedom and positivity about us and how we could spread our wings. And, you know, there was never, when I said I was moving to New York, which was for them very far away, like another planet they'd never been, there was absolutely no question. It was just, they just gently pushed me there with all love and support. So I feel I had a very happy childhood, very safe and secure.
And what was your relationship with your sister like at that point? And these questions are relevant, of course.
Yeah, of course. They come out in the story. We were very, very close. 3 years apart. I was the older. And yeah, we grew up incredibly close. It was only until later that things started to fall apart.
Right. Let's go to New York now.
I'd love to.
You've described it as having really the kind of Sex and the City lifestyle.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, we did. It was the 80s. New York was at its peak. I mean, I really felt that. I arrived. That sort of classic Midwest girl who's pretty naive but full of confidence goes to the big city and is immediately knocked down. I mean, it took a long time to get a job, but I was absolutely fearless. And in fact, my first job, I just got a phone book and started with A under graphic designers, because that's what my training was. And my job came with Mr. Ash Design. So I didn't have to go very far. But it took me a long time to work out how to do that. And then my real first job was at Cosmo magazine. So I worked under Helen Gurley Brown, which was quite a thing, in the fashion department.
Wow, what were you doing for that?
I literally didn't know what I was doing. I was the junior fashion assistant and working on the fashion pages.
I mean, that is, you know, as they say, the devil wears Prada, this is literally every girl's dream job.
Yeah. No, it was. It was amazing. I landed it purely by mistake. But I think my life has been like that, just sort of very lucky. And I became best friends with my boss, basically. And was there, didn't understand anything about fashion, but had a great time. And that rolled out into the Sex and the City lifestyle. You know, we had a lot of money, we had a lot of drinks, we had a lot of boys, we ran fast. I was young. It was fun.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Did you get lots of great clothes?
No, it was Cosmo. Not great. Cosmo was all about candies. Do you remember those shoes? Probably not. I don't know if they were here. Kind of strapless, backless heels. So you literally couldn't walk in them. That was the Cosmo look. That says it all. Let's just keep them immobile.
Why did you leave New York?
I left New York after 10 years because I met my now husband, Paul, who was there making a film. And I was tired of New York. There's a real burnout factor in New York after a while. So we met and fell in love. So we very slowly worked out what our future would be together because it was very complicated. But I was ready to leave New York, so I moved to London.
And here you still are 30 years later.
And here I am.
So you moved to London and you start doing illustrations.
I do. So I moved to London. And the reason I started being a cartoonist was I had a baby quite late in life. And after about a year or two, when he was old enough for me to like really entertain him, I started sketching with him, drawing. And these became cartoons. And those were seen by an editor at The Spectator. And those started running in The Spectator. And then it just flew. And I don't know, it just happened. I hadn't really sat down and said, I'm going to be a cartoonist.
So tell us about the character Mimi.
Right. So Mimi came out of, I couldn't have done her unless I was a mother myself, because I always say that she represents the dark side of motherhood, you know, that sort of selfish, yeah, very self-involved, the core of you that is really challenged and almost stripped away when you have a baby, because they need all of your attention. And you're willing to give it, but there's a part of you that misses you and your needs. So I had a fantastic time writing her because she is outrageous. And, you know, the baby just has to fit into her life. Not the other way. A lot of people make compromises. But no, the baby just goes in her handbag when she has to go shopping.
And doesn't even have a name, which is...
I never named the baby. I'm sure my son will need therapy. No, he has no name. He says one word. One word in 10 years of cartooning with him. Help.
Mimi wears only black.
Yep.
She's very thin.
She's very thin. She's not me.
Is she not you?
No, she's not me. Definitely not. Don't say that now. I run. If ever I... Look, I'm in all black, but normally, you know, when I was drawing her, I didn't. I didn't want to be compared to her.
Yeah, yeah. But has this kind of fashionista type lifestyle?
Yeah, and of its time, I think, you know. So this is, what, 10 years ago. I did note in New York that a lot of people were having babies, you know, my age, but were very stylish people, had houses that were all white and, you know, had a lot of money. So the baby became another accessory, which was funny.
You went on then, she appeared, long-running cartoons,
yes,
in newspapers.
Yes.
And then you did a book.
And then I did a collection of the cartoons. Yeah, that was a Kickstarter campaign, which was great. When Kickstarter was really kind of fresh and happening and people were keen to invest. So we raised a lot of money on Kickstarter and self-published.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, it was great. It was fun.
So what's the difference then? Because that was a published collection of cartoons. This is your first graphic novel. Can you explain the difference for anyone who might be unfamiliar with that format?
Definitely. And this is my mission, is to get people involved in this book who may not ever have read a graphic novel or don't even know what it is. In fact, there are two editions of this book. There's a UK and a North America edition. And they're the same image, but on the cover in the UK, it says an illustrated story. And in the US, it says a family memoir. And I really wanted to not say graphic novel on the cover, because I think it might scare people. And really, the kind of many reviews I've had so far in the build-up to the publication of the book, the kind of one of the common threads is people say, I don't read graphic novels, I've never read one before, but I love this. So it's a kind of easy entry, because it's not like, I think a lot of people think of a graphic novel as like a comic book. And I tried very hard to steer away from that. So I feel it's more illustrated. There are no boxes. You know, the flow of the illustrations flow with the words. It's more like a storyboard for a film. And in fact, I sort of feel that's the way to pitch it. It's like watching a film, because you can read it in about 2 hours. I mean, if you want, you can sit down and read it. You can go slower. So the illustrations are as important as the words. And I think because I came from a cartooning background, which requires me to very much edit my words. The cartoons I did were like one gag line. So my skill is really editing. Mm. And I mean, I could never write a novel of prose, I'm sure. It would have to be like haiku after haiku. So this has that distillation of the words, but the punch of the images with it. Kind of like, you know, when you're a child and those great books that were illustrated and you read, but, you know, the illustrations were as important. It brought you into that world. Mm. I love that. This is like an adult children's book.
It is autobiographical. It's your memoir,
it is,
really.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's about your mother.
Correct.
So tell us. Tell us the story.
Well, I should preface it by saying it's a very common story. This is the thing. I mean, I remember when I told you that you have the same story in your life. And when I started working on this, and I would say what I was working on at dinner parties and, you know, socially, everyone always had a story in their life similar to mine. So my mom, who is 90-something, fell at home. I had to rush out to help her.
And to Cedar Rapids.
To Cedar Rapids. Yeah, I flew to Cedar Rapids. What I thought was going to be a few weeks turned into almost 2 months, and it required me to decide her future. So while I was there, I kept a diary because I was so bored. It was very long days. I was either sitting next to her in the care home or at home on my own, my family home. So I kept a diary. So the story comes from the diary, and I'm not sure I could have written it without that, because in the moment I was writing my feelings very strongly, and so I had that, you know, I could refer back to that. Because I didn't start on it right away. It took me a couple of years to get going on this. But what was amazing was that before I arrived, there was this weather system, this polar vortex that was coming. And there was this huge threat of this weather system, which did arrive, which was life-threatening. And as I... So that's just huge amounts of snow, you know, wind chill that's going to freeze your lungs. I mean, very dangerous stuff. And that became a metaphor for my mom's dementia. I realized as I was later writing the story, it was a brilliant way of illustrating her dementia, because it was this swirling, snowy confusion that she got lost in. And so the title, which I had to really fight for, because it's an unusual title,
yeah.
I think in the end is I think it's a very powerful title, actually.
Absolutely. There are wonderful depictions of your mother. Her eyes go completely different when she's in her little polar storm.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, in fact, again, like a storyboard, I realized the power was in her face. You know, dementia kind of, it's not a constant state. It comes and goes. And when it arrives, they are full of fear. My mother was full of fear. So having that full-on image, a full-page spread of her and the fear in her eyes, I thought was very, very powerful.
It really is. I mean, the drawings are exquisite. Tell us a little bit about your technique.
So I left pen and ink on paper, which is what I used to do. Mimi was drawn analog. And I got an iPad and an iPencil. And that changed my life. So I don't create paper images anymore. It's all digital. But because of the brushes and the tools that are so advanced in that digital world, it looks like I've drawn it with ink and it's watercolor. But it's not. It's all digital.
And does that... Going digital, has that changed how the process feels for you?
No, not at all. No. In fact, I'm glad I don't have boxes and boxes of paper, which is what I have for Mimi. Which, why? Who wants those? But, yeah.
So you're there, you're looking after your mother, you're keeping your diary, this weather system is there, she's losing it, and you're having to decide what to do because of her health insurance.
Well, exactly. And although it's set in America and the situation is slightly different, I think it's what's similar between here and similar between there and anywhere is that these decisions you have to make about their care. So it's a kind of global issue, really. So in America, you do have private insurance, which a lot of people pay for. In fact, this was very hard to illustrate in the book because it's so boring. And I can see you going to sleep as I say it. How do you talk about insurance, medical insurance? So I you know, this was the fun about illustrating it, because I could then turn it into a game show or take her somewhere else. I mean, it was just, I could visually escape the facts and make them fun to read. So my mom did have private health insurance, like everyone, and paid a fortune for it for her, you know, for her whole adult life. The return was so minimal. It would provide a little bit of care at home, maybe an hour or two. That was it. And if she were to stay in the care system, then it's all about getting better. So the pressure for someone who's ill and being looked after by insurance, which is all free in the beginning, the pressure for them to get well and hit targets is ridiculous. So my mother was, you know, I came in one morning, my mother was on a, you know, like a rowing machine. She's 91. And they were trying to, you know, meet these insurance targets. So, you know, she obviously had to show maybe that she, whatever that target was, they were pushing her to meet that. And it's a very quick timeline. So we were under a lot of pressure to make a decision about her future.
And this is you and your sister.
This is me and my sister, yeah.
Now, why did you, the two of you, fall out? Because you hadn't been speaking.
That's right. I mean, we were very close, and we navigated my father's death very well together. And something shifted when my mom became ill. I think the crux of it, I think I can say, I can't speak for my sister, but I would say we became very different how we wanted to approach my mother's future. Even when she was at home, I wanted to keep her at home. I was kind of, you know, under some illusion that she could manage at home on her own, because I felt she was safer there. My sister wanted to get her into care as quick as possible. So already, very early on, after my father died, which was in 2013, and then my mother was alone for the first time in her life, our differences became magnified. And she started to really panic about my mother, and I became completely, you know, reacting against that.
And she lives in the United States.
She lives in the US. She lives on the West Coast.
So not close.
So neither of us were close.
Yeah.
And I think it just tore us apart, and we couldn't come to some agreement. And, you know, I guess it was easier for us to stop talking. It wasn't, but in a way, it was how we dealt with it. Mm. We stopped communicating. So I was there trying to make decisions about my mom, which I knew affected my sister, without her input.
Yeah. And you illustrate that very well. I mean, we see your confusion, we see your anger and your fear.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was very strong. And again, it was just so pressurized. There was no time at all.
What happened eventually?
Well, in the book, I had great fun writing my fantasy of what happened, which is that we make up and my mother goes to live with her and everything's, you know, it's not rosy. The ending is quite poignant, I hope. So that's, I decided to make that sort of reconciliation, because I think the reader needs that. It's too dark otherwise to leave it. It's already dark because my mum's, you know, losing her mind, and it's not clear what her future is. And we all know, as at the end of the book, I'm never going to see her again, probably. So I put in that rosy kind of reunion for me and the reader.
So that didn't happen?
No, we still don't speak.
Quite sure where to go from there.
I know, it's tough. And I have to be careful, you know, because it's my side of the story. And she looked after my mom in real life, did go live with her, and she looked after my mom very well, she and her husband. I think it took its toll very much. You know, because you looked after your mom. But I was very grateful that she did that, actually. I was just sad that we couldn't share what we were both going through.
That is very sad, because, of course, you'd lost a sibling previously.
Yeah, my brother died when he was 36 from a brain tumor. So, yeah, we had... I think, you know, again, these sort of stories are very common. Siblings fall out when parents start to decay. There's where is the leadership, where is the platform that the children sort of sit on very safely, you know, and then it turns, you're looking after the parent who's falling apart. So I think it happens a lot.
Yeah. And what about this problem of writing about other people that anybody who does a memoir is faced with?
Totally. What a great question, because I grappled with that. I still grapple with that. I'm still worried about, well, for example, my sister, how she's going to accept this. And I understand that reality is different, you know, for every person. We can share the same event, but our perspectives are going to be very different. So I accept that. I wrote it for my mom. My mom died in COVID, not of COVID, but during COVID. We had no memorial. We had nothing. And I think that was so hard on us. And I was in London and she died in America. It was awful. And so I've really written it for her to kind of honor her life and her memory, because dotted throughout is a bit about her too and her childhood and her background, you know, because in dementia, she traveled a lot to her past very accurately. Mm-hmm. And it's an homage to her and her life, really.
Yeah. And do you know if your sister's seen it?
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope she does.
I want to go back just a little bit. You talk about your mother's childhood and her life in it. Mm. Tell us a little bit more about her background.
Very classic Midwest life. Grew up on a farm. Her father was a farmer. Her mother, you know, was the farmer's wife. She was born very late to her mother. And so her sister's children, which she was their aunt, were her age. So when she was born, her sister was having a baby. Hmm. And I think she always felt she was the favorite. Her stories of childhood were always that she was the golden one. And, you know, she came along and such as her mother must have been late 40s when she had her. So very fond memories of being on the farm. And when I was in the nursing home with her and she, in her dementia, one day I found and I was just bored and I Googled a newspaper from her, like 1929. And I read her the society page and she remembered everyone. She knew, she said, oh, that's the, ooh, she was a floozy or, you know, that he drank a lot. You know, she had all the gossip on these people. She remembered it with pin sharpness. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
Now, this book was getting great reviews before it even came out.
Yeah.
Just blown away by the reaction to it. It's been extreme. Oprah Winfrey, what did she say?
Oprah said that, it was one of 12 top graphic novels of 24. I mean, and that was announced in 23. So, and I, you know, I'm listed with like my heroes, Mouse and Persepolis and, you know, some very, in fact, I would recommend reading those other graphic novels. It was very exciting. Oprah said it was, you know, well, I can't remember the quote, but, you know, visually beautiful and humorous. And yeah, I was thrilled.
And of course it is. It's this very universal subject, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think everybody, like I say, you know, if I started talking about the plot at a dinner party, a lot of people would just, I wouldn't even say two sentences and they would jump in with, people want to share that thing. I think that's the thing about when there's a difficult event in your life, if you meet someone who's experienced it, it's an instant bond. And people just want to express themselves and share it. You know, it's like the club that you really don't want to join, but there you are, you're in it. And if you meet someone, it's so reassuring.
Yeah. And it's the opposite of sort of Mimi and her baby in that the baby grows up. But when you're looking after an adult dependent who also behaves like a baby or like a toddler, it's only going in one direction.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I did find my mum's neediness difficult. I mean, I think I slightly regret now. I think I've read a lot about dementia now. I kind of avoided educating myself deeply about it when we were in it. I mean, it all happened so fast as well, but I remember when I was flying her out to live with my sister, you know, she was freaking on the plane, absolutely freaking, and I didn't know what to do. And I just took her hand, and it instantly calmed her down. And I think she just wanted affection. You know, her demands, she was quite, you know, she needed attention. And while I sometimes found that difficult, I wish I'd given her more in that time, actually. She just wanted someone close to her. Pretty much all the time, because I think it's quite scary, dementia. I think it's terrifying. So that would be my advice. Anybody living with this, just give them all the affection you can. It really works.
Yeah. Denise, what's next for you?
Well, I really want to do another graphic novel. It's hard work. I have to prepare myself for at least a year of sitting at my desk. Maybe that's a novel too. I don't know. But maybe it's longer for a novel, I'm sure. But I have a few ideas kicking around. I might go back to New York and look at that time.
Exciting stuff. Mm-hmm. Whatever comes next, I'm sure it's going to be fabulous. So Polar Vortex, an illustrated story, is by Denise Starrance. It's published by New River Books. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Tamsin Howard, Lily Austin and Mariella Bevan. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.